Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. After lagging far behind other solid tumors in terms of clinical research, lung cancer is moving along quickly, particularly with respect to the use of biologic agents. I met with Dr. Ron Natale for an update of his research interest, and he began by commenting on EGFR mutations.
It was serendipitous that Iressa Tarceva, inhibitors that were designed to target the wild-type receptor, actually fit into the ATP binding cleft so avidly in the mutated form of the receptor. And when you do X-ray crystallographic studies, you can actually directly visualize how well they fit and bind into that binding site. What's very interesting is that some people now believe that going forward, as we identify these dominant oncogenes, we'll actually be able to develop inhibitors that are specific for the mutation that won't bind to the wild-type receptor and that will therefore have zero toxicity.
The other thing I've been hearing a lot about is T790 mutation. Can you go through that? And now I'm starting to hear about, quote, irreversible EGFR TKIs.
This entire phenomena has been termed by Bernie Weinstein of Columbia as oncogene addiction, that despite these multiple genetic abnormalities that we see in lung cancer, that quite remarkably, there's one or two dominant oncogenes that seem to drive the growth of the cancer. In this case, the mutated EGF receptor. And when you block it with Iressa or Tarceva, you exert such strong selective pressure on the cancer cells that they can actually reemerge with a new mutation, in this case, the T790M mutation, that restores the signaling pathway. It again is sort of a reflection of how important that signaling pathway from the mutated EGF receptor was to the maintenance of the survival of the cancer cell, that it was able to acquire de novo, or perhaps by selection, a mutation that gave it resistance to Iressa and Tarceva.
When I've seen those crystallography things, it looks like the T790 mutation sort of pushes the TKI out, sort of?
That was one of the hypotheses. What we now think is that what happens is the T790M mutation increases the avidity of the ATP binding domain for ATP by 20-fold or more, which means that Iressa and Tarceva just compete much more poorly. And there's some evidence to suggest that some of the new EGFR kinase inhibitors, especially those that bind covalently to the ATP binding domain, may sterically inhibit that increased avidity for ATP binding.
So there's the BIBW2992 as an example of, quote, an irreversible EGFR TKI.
Exactly. And this is an irreversible TKI. There's some preclinical evidence that suggests that it may overcome T790M mutation. There's other preclinical evidence that suggests that maybe it won't. You know, in the 1990s, we began to understand that cancer is not a disease of abnormal cellular proliferation. It's actually a disease of abnormal cellular survival. And now with improved technology, we're beginning to understand that it's the survival signals, the pro-survival signals that occur with all these genetic mutations that really set the balance for continued unbridled growth of a malignancy. That treatment that addresses only the proliferative side of this process has modest effectiveness. But treatment like Iressa and Tarceva, when you were talking about an EGFR mutation, or some of these other novel drugs that are being developed, imatinib or Gleevec, that targets a novel BCR-ABL fusion protein, that these produce apoptosis, and that results in a far more dramatic effect on outcome.
So I wanted to actually chat with you a little bit about small cell.
Please.
Just for the heck of it.
Yeah.
People say, we never talk about small cell. So let's talk about small cell since you've done so much work on that. And also I wanted to ask you about the JCO paper that you all put out looking at the pharmacogenomic issues. Can you go through the whole study, what the background was, what you saw, and then this recent stuff about the pharmacogenomics?
Sure. Well, as you and your audience know, irinotecan is an important drug. It belongs to the class of drugs that we call camptothecins. And these drugs are important inhibitors of topoisomerase 1. And what's really very interesting is that it's not just a topo 1 inhibitor camptothecins inhibit topo-1 DNA combined, which, when you stop to think about it, is an incredibly novel target. So unlike many of our chemotherapy drugs that have a target and have off-target effects, the camptothecins are incredibly specific for topo-1 binding directly to the binding site in DNA. These drugs are potent inhibitors. They act primarily on cycling cells, and the Japanese were the first to do some of the fundamental studies indicating that irinotecan seemed to have single-agent activity in the second-line setting in patients with advanced small cell lung cancer. They then did a phase 2 study looking at it in the first-line setting combined with cisplatin in patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer, and found that it produced an objective response rate that appeared to be better than what they would have expected with standard cisplatin etoposide. The Japanese then went on to do a very important randomized phase 3 trial, JCOG 9509, published in New England Journal of Medicine, that randomized patients to cisplatin irinotecan or cisplatin etoposide. In that study, the patients who received the cisplatin irinotecan had a higher objective response rate, stable disease rate, and an improved median 1-year and 2-year survival compared to cisplatin etoposide.
Was it clinically meaningful, the numbers?
The improvement in survival was extraordinary improvement in survival. The biggest gain in survival we've seen in small cell lung cancer in the last 20 years. And in this study, it's important to add that the response and the survival outcome of the control arm, cisplatin etoposide, appeared to be the same as we've seen in study after study in U.S. cooperative groups with cisplatin etoposide.
What were the median survivals in the two groups again? About?
The median survival with cisplatin etoposide was in the range of 9.5 to 10 months, and with cisplatin irinotecan, remembering these were extensive stage small cell lung cancer, was a little over a year. So, relatively speaking, that's an impressive improvement in survival. It reached highly statistically significant difference with only about 77 patients per arm.
Why does it not sound that exciting?
I guess it depends on your perspective. I guess
more clinically.
We've had platinum and etoposide since the early 80s, and we've not made any gains whatsoever in outcome. And here's all of a sudden a different two-drug combination that just substitutes irinotecan for etoposide and improves the survival by more than 25-30%.
Yeah, but it's still only a couple months. You see a lot of that in lung cancer, and I don't know, maybe that's an intermediate step to something better?
Perhaps.
So in any event, you wanted to confirm it?
Yes. And there were two important U.S. studies that attempted to confirm it. One was a North American trial in which they changed the dose and the schedule of the cisplatin etoposide to make it more amenable to outpatient cancer practice in the United States. They noticed that in the Japanese study, about 40% of patients could not receive the irinotecan on day 15 because of hematologic toxicity. So that being the case, they designed a study where they dropped the day 15 dose, and rather than giving platinum and irinotecan every 4 weeks, they gave it every 3 weeks. So patients got platinum and irinotecan on day 1, irinotecan on day 8, and then recycled on day 21. When you look at the amount of platinum and irinotecan that patients received in this trial, compared to the Japanese study, and the control arm was the same platinum etoposide, you know, they actually received more platinum and irinotecan than the Japanese were able to deliver. Despite that, there was no difference in the response rate, median survival, 1-year, 2-year survival whatsoever. It was a completely negative study. There were, of course, some differences with respect to toxicity. I had the privilege of heading the Southwest Oncology Group trial that became an important intergroup study. This was a large study. Unlike the Japanese trial, they had 154 patients. This trial had over 630 patients. We did not change the dose and schedule of administration at all. We used the same dose and schedule of platinum and irinotecan, platinum etoposide that the Japanese used. We collected blood from patients at the start of study, from as many as we could, to do some pharmacogenomic work. The results of our study were the same as a North American trial. No difference in response rate, median survival, 1-year survival in the two arms of the study, absolutely identical, just different toxicity. We were hoping that our pharmacogenomic studies would identify a subpopulation of North American patients who had a similar camptothecin metabolic profile as Japanese patients, that they would metabolize camptothecin in the same way that Japanese patients metabolize it, and that that subset of patients would have an important improvement in response rate and survival outcome. But we could not identify a single subpopulation of patients, either based on demographics, patient characteristics, or based on their metabolic profile, that had an advantage with platinum and irinotecan compared to platinum and etoposide.
What is being looked at right now in terms of clinical research?
A lot of clinical research is turning to biologics, trying to find a biologic target that will improve the outcome.
Anything promising?
Not yet. I think that, you know, we're looking at tumor cell stromal interactions, so we're looking at things like bevacizumab, looking at some of the other novel VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We all know that small cell lung cancer appears to be a fairly vascular kind of tumor, grows more proximally in the lung, nearer to some large blood vessels, that it may be a disease that there's a lot of VEGF that's secreted by small cell lung cancers. So it may be playing some important role that we might be able to exploit.
So to what extent have VEGF inhibitors like Bev or TKIs been looked at in small cell?
Well, the studies that have been done have been primarily small studies, some uncontrolled phase 2 trials. NCI Canada did a randomized phase 2 trial with one of the VEGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. At least we can say that on the safety side, there does not appear to be a safety issue. There may have been some concern that because small cell lung cancer is such a proximal disease, nearer to large blood vessels, could there be an increased propensity for pulmonary hemorrhage? And that appears not to be the case. On the other hand, on the efficacy side, the results have not been impressive. We do need to go forward and do some purposeful clinical trials, but right now I think no one's holding their breath that this is going to be a significant breakthrough.
So going back to non-small cell, let me throw out a few common situations and ask you generally how you approach them. Let's start with adjuvant therapy, patient with stage 2 disease, otherwise healthy, smoker, non-EGFR mutation profile. How do you generally approach adjuvant therapy?
I discuss with the patient, you know, the results of clinical trials that have unequivocally demonstrated that adjuvant chemotherapy can improve that patient's outcome. Now, there's no question that the clinical trials show greater benefit to those patients who have low-volume stage 3A disease compared to 2B, compared to 2A, and no benefit when you get down to patients with stage 1B disease unless they've got tumors that are greater than 4 or 5 centimeters in diameter. So for the kind of patient you've described with stage 2 lung cancer, I talk about the fact that adjuvant chemotherapy can produce a modest improvement in their survival outcome, and that we've got a number of chemotherapy regimens now that we can consider that are fairly well tolerated. And I think certainly if the patient has a non-squamous cell, non-small cell lung cancer, I think I would not hesitate to use Alimta combined with either cisplatin or carboplatin as adjuvant treatment for that patient. Now, most of my lung cancer colleagues strongly adhere to using cisplatin as the preferred drug in the adjuvant setting. And for the young, healthy patient that you've described, I certainly agree with that. This patient should be able to tolerate outpatient cisplatin combined with pemetrexed if it's a non-squamous cell, non-small cell lung cancer patient, 4 cycles reasonably well. I don't hesitate in those patients when I run into problems with renal function to switch to carboplatin. For my patients who are not quite as healthy, and for my elderly patients, and I have a lot of elderly patients in Southern California who, although are quite healthy, they are elderly, and they don't tolerate chemotherapy as well as younger patients. And we should be reminded that the median age of lung cancer in the United States is 71. So clinical trials that we look at that report median ages of 64, 65, there's obviously been some selective exclusion of patients over the age of 70, 75, and octogenarians. For those patients, I routinely will treat with carboplatin and pemetrexed if it's a non-squamous, carboplatin and Gemzar if it's a squamous cell cancer. I believe that carboplatin has an important role to play for about half of my patients with lung cancer in the adjuvant setting.
Are you participating in the ECOG study looking at chemo plus or minus Bev?
or not participating in the ECOG trial, my institution is a Southwest Oncology Group site, I think all of us look forward with a great deal of anticipation regarding that study, and we're all quite disappointed by the results that were presented at ESCO, showing, and perhaps it should not have come as any big surprise,
that was in colon cancer.
In colon cancer patients, that the use of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting, a setting in which we're talking about micrometastatic disease. We're not talking about disease that gets to the size of a cluster of cancer cells where angiogenesis is an important component. That it's interesting that bevacizumab did not produce the improvement in survival that we had hoped for. And as I said, perhaps on the biological level, that makes sense. So we'll see what the results are in lung cancer. The ECOG trial is a very important study. It needs to be done, and we look forward to the results.
Are you participating in any adjuvant trials?
I'm participating in some of the vaccine adjuvant trials with the MAGE vaccine. I think there are some vaccines that are coming to the fore in lung cancer that have some promise. I think administering them to patients following adjuvant chemotherapy is a good setting. It's a setting in which the tumor volume is quite low. We're selecting patients whose tumors express the MAGE antigen, which is about 25 to 30% of the patient population. So I think that's an important study. We're also participating in the RADIANT trial. And now, given the results of SATURN in patients with advanced disease, the RADIANT trial emerges as a potentially important study. This is a study in patients who have early stage lung cancer that have undergone complete surgical resection and meticulous mediastinal staging, who can receive adjuvant chemotherapy, and after the completion of their 3 or 4 cycles of adjuvant chemotherapy, they are then randomized on the RADIANT trial to receive Tarceva or placebo for up to 2 years. If Tarceva can improve the survival of patients with stage 3B4 lung cancer as maintenance therapy following chemotherapy induction, then the possibility that it could improve survival a bit further in the adjuvant setting is quite exciting.
Now, before you discuss the RADIANT trial further, I want to backtrack to the SATURN trial that you just mentioned to remind our listeners that SATURN randomized patients with advanced disease who had not progressed on platinum-based chemo to maintenance erlotinib versus placebo, regardless of EGFR status. And the study showed that maintenance erlotinib was associated with a PFS benefit in all comers, although the benefit was particularly dramatic for the subset with EGFR mutations. Let's also remind folks here the ATLAS study, which is similar to SATURN, but looked at maintenance Bev versus maintenance Bev plus erlotinib in patients with advanced disease, again, regardless of EGFR status, who not progressed on initial treatment with Bev plus platinum-based doublet chemo, and showed that the addition of erlotinib to Bev in the maintenance setting also resulted in significant PFS benefit to all comers. So now let's go back to the RADIANT trial, which moves erlotinib up into the adjuvant setting. What's the entry criteria for the study?
Well, patients have to have stage 1B, 2A, 2B, or completely resected 3A disease. And there are some important staging aspects that they have to have undergone a fairly complete mediastinal lymph node dissection.
But in terms of biology, EGFR, non-smoking, it's all comers.
Yeah, it's all comers. There is a request for archival tissue from all the patients so that we can subsequently go back and retrospectively see if the EGFR mutated group or not, where there's a group that preferentially benefited.
What about the patient who has an EGFR mutation in the adjuvant setting, non-smoker, post-op, stage 2 disease? Theoretically, you could put them in a trial. Let's just put a trial aside. Obviously, the question is, would you consider integrating an EGFR TKI or erlotinib into non-protocol therapy of a patient like that?
Well, that's always a difficult issue because we do have this accumulating evidence that the presence of an EGFR mutation predicts that a high proportion of these patients are going to have disease that's hypersensitive to Tarceva or Iressa, and so it's quite tempting to use that drug. In my own practice, I remain committed to putting patients on the RADIANT trial because I'm anxious to help contribute to the database, so it will help to answer that question. But again, because of the kind of practice that I have, I see some fairly sophisticated patients. I have one patient who's a never-smoking Asian female who's 51 years old and a dermatologist. And she's undergone resection of what was a stage 2 lung cancer, an adenocarcinoma, We did EGFR mutation testing on it, and she has a mutation.
Which one?
She's got a mutation. She's got the L858R mutation, one of the most common mutations that we find in about 45% of the cases.
So what's she doing?
So, well, now armed with this knowledge, and I have continued to encourage her to go on to the Radiant trial, she says that she just wants to take Tarceva on her own.
What about chemo?
Oh, we're certainly treating her with four cycles of platinum pemetrexed, and then she'll take their lives. So we're going to do it sequentially.
And how long are you going to treat her for?
We're going to do what the standard is now in the Radiant trial, and I think what is a reasonable standard, namely 2 years of oral Tarceva.
And has she started the chemo yet?
Yeah, she's into her third cycle of chemotherapy, so we'll complete four cycles, and then we'll go on to oral Tarceva.
Interesting that she's a dermatologist.
She's a dermatologist,
she
so she's quite knowledgeable.
She
yeah.
can get herself through 2 years of her lot, and it'll be interesting.
Yeah, and I think it remains to be seen if there'll be an insurance issue.
How about locally advanced disease, chemo radiation?
Well, this remains the most heterogeneous group of patients that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's the group of patients that we spend the greatest amount of discussion at our tumor boards at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center because there's no uniform consensus as to the best treatment option. Some patients are best treated with preoperative chemotherapy. Some may be best treated with combined preoperative chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Many patients, and perhaps the majority in that category, are best treated with combined concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy. I've got an interesting example, a patient that I saw a few months ago, a 62-year-old man who had had about a six-month history of left shoulder and arm pain. He actually underwent surgery in his left shoulder to repair, you know, some tendon tears. Well, the surgery didn't benefit him. The pain persisted afterwards. And he was finally found to have a left apical tumor mass. And on staging, this tumor mass is obviously abutting right up against vertebral bodies and ribs, possibly invading mediastinum, clearly involving brachial plexus, causing the severe left shoulder and arm pain, and what at this time now was progressively increasing left arm weakness. We performed a CT-guided biopsy of this mass. We actually had to do it twice. Our first attempt was not successful. And it just shows you that some of these tumors that are in difficult to access places, even though this tumor had a diameter of nearly 5 centimeters, that you've got to keep trying. Well, the biopsy indicated that this was non-small cell lung cancer, an adenocarcinoma. So I treated this patient with cisplatin pemetrexed concurrent with radiation therapy. We gave him 5,000 centigray of radiation therapy over about a five and a half week period. We were able to get in 3 cycles of platinum pemetrexed. Radiographically, he had an excellent objective response. And when this patient was taken to surgery, there was only a single small microscopic focus of cancer left in what was a large fibrotic and necrotic tumor mass. So his prospects looked very good postoperatively. He recovered from his surgery. The arm pain eventually dissipated. We were able to stop his Neurontin and his narcotic analgesics, regained appetite and weight, and was ready to return to work. 6 months after surgery, I got a routine PET CT scan just to reassess where things were. I always like to delay that PET CT scan. I don't ever get it less than 3 months following radiation therapy because I think radiation can induce some artifacts and not really give you a true picture of what's going on. His PET CT scan demonstrated no uptake in the apex and mediastinal region of the lung. It really was an excellent objective response. But we had 2 intra-abdominal lymph nodes that lit up on the PET scan. We went and obtained a CT-directed biopsy and confirmed that he had recurrent adenocarcinoma in 2 periaortic lymph nodes.
Only there?
Only there. Incredibly disappointing. Now, the decision is, what do you do going forward? Well, what we opted to do was to give this patient stereotactic radiation therapy aimed directly at these 2 contiguous periaortic lymph nodes. There's no reason for me to rush into chemotherapy for stage 4 disease. I was holding out that the solitary site of relapse might perhaps be his only site, and perhaps eradicating it with radiation therapy might salvage the cure that I thought we had with our induction chemotherapy and radiation therapy and surgery. We'll see.
What are some of the research questions that are being asked in these patients that you think may lead to something positive in the future? Okay. And I'm curious particularly what you think about the issue of bringing in an agent like cetuximab.
Well, these are going to be important questions to look at the contribution of biologic agents to chemotherapy, radiation therapy combinations. Certainly the importance of cetuximab concurrent with radiation therapy in patients with head and neck cancer really, I think, helps to heighten the issue that it could also be quite helpful in patients with lung cancer. There are going to be different issues and challenges, especially with regard to the radiation field that in this case is going to encompass a significant portion of the esophagus that's going to undergo a lot of radiation sensitization that it already does with chemotherapy, but perhaps even more so now with cetuximab. So it remains to work out some of the challenges of dose and scheduling.
Although from what I understand in head and neck cancer, because granted not the same issue, but there's still a lot of normal tissues being exposed, is that they haven't seen that much excess toxicity. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding as well. But I think in lung cancer, I'm somewhat concerned.
Sure.
Especially given the length of the esophagus that's likely to be included. And no matter how careful the three-dimensional treatment planning is and IMRT and whatever novel radiation treatment technology is brought to bear, the esophagus remains right in the middle of that treatment field for most patients.
What data do we have right now on the issue in lung cancer, cetuximab radiation?
Well, it's certainly feasible. We can do it safely, and some of the preliminary results are cautiously encouraging. I think that now it's time to proceed with the randomized trials to see if this is a step forward. On the positive side, again, is this regimen that I used in my patient, platinum pemetrexed, that in contrast to some of the other regimens we've used, whether it's platinum combined with either of the taxanes or old-fashioned platinum etoposide, platinum pemetrexed is remarkably well-tolerated concurrently with radiation therapy. We're able to give full doses of the chemotherapy concurrently with a full dose of radiation therapy reasonably safely.
Let's talk a little bit about advanced disease and, again, sort of your general approach to patients. Let's start out with squamous cell.
Well, with squamous cell, you know, this, with all the breakthrough treatments with pemetrexed and with bevacizumab, you know, has sort of been the unwanted child. Fortunately, I think the results with cetuximab at least are encouraging in squamous cell cancer in that the modest benefit in survival that occurred in the FLEX study occurred independent of histologic type. So that is one option. Remains to be seen whether it's an option that will be FDA approved and that will become an accepted standard of care from the FDA perspective.
How many patients, if any, have you treated that way in the last year?
I've treated none, but part of that owes the fact that my squamous cell population is almost non-existent. I don't see more than two or three squamous cell cancer patients a year now.
Wow.
Even though I see about 6 to 8 new lung cancer patients a week.
So, but if you did see a patient like that, you would be thinking about cetuximab.
I certainly would be considering cetuximab in an off-protocol setting. Fortunately, I'm participating in some clinical trials that involve antibodies to the IGF-1 receptor.
Keep hearing about those things.
And that looks quite exciting.
Is that right? Have responses been observed to that alone, or is it given with chemo?
No, again, I think, and the emerging data with antibodies across the board, interestingly enough, is that these drugs don't work so much alone, but they need to work with chemotherapy.
Let's talk about adenocarcinoma, and let's just make it BEV-eligible and no contraindications. How do you approach those patients in terms of advanced disease?
Well, we have two FDA-approved treatments now. We have the FDA-approved bevacizumab with carboplatin and paclitaxel, and we've got platinum and pemetrexed. When you look at the NCCN guidelines, they say that bevacizumab is recommended to be used with any first-line platinum-based regimen in patients who have this adenocarcinoma with none of the other factors that would exclude them from use of bevacizumab. And, of course, we have an important pilot study that was conducted by Jody Patel at Northwestern, where she selected 55 patients who met all of the eligibility criteria of ECOG 4599 and treated them with carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. The objective response rate was 51%. The median survival was 14.5 months. Now, That appears to be better than we saw in the ECOG 4599 study with carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, although we have to remember that this is an uncontrolled phase 2 study in a selected group of patients.
Indirect comparison.
So it's an indirect comparison.
It's only a couple months different too, right?
Yes. But at least there is now a randomized trial that's in progress in which patients who are bevacizumab eligible are randomized to carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, the FDA-approved standard, or carboplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab, this new regimen. After the induction cycles, the 4 cycles of induction therapy, the carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab arm patients who have response or stable disease go on to receive bevacizumab maintenance. The carboplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab arm patients will go on to receive bevacizumab pemetrexed as maintenance therapy. So it does open the question of what is the best maintenance regimen now for these patients, these bevacizumab-eligible patients, as you put it.
Suppose someone were to say, and I've had a couple of the people involved in the FLEX studies say to me, of course, they're from Europe and different perspective, that they think that putting aside reimbursement costs and just pure risk-benefit, they think the risk-benefit ratio is better with cetuximab chemo in the BEV-eligible patients than BEV chemo, no hemoptysis, you know, maybe same benefit. What do you think?
Well, certainly the Europeans are strongly influenced by their AVAIL study, by the cisplatin GEMSAR with or without bevacizumab trial, in which they had a progression-free survival advantage with either the 7.5 or the 15 milligram per kilogram dose of bevacizumab compared to cisplatin GEMSAR control arm, but no overall survival advantage. And so we're left with
As opposed to 5 weeks in cetuximab.
Yeah. And so we're left with a very positive ECOG 4599 study, a study that was well-designed and very well-conducted. We've got a not-so-positive European study, and I've got some issues with how that study was designed and how it was conducted. But nevertheless, with respect to overall survival, as Dave Johnson says, it did not seal the deal for bevacizumab in the treatment of patients with lung cancer. So the Europeans, I think, are reluctant to turn to bevacizumab, both because of costs and because of risks. Now, in terms of risk, what's notable is that there have been large registrational studies that have been performed in the United States where community oncologists treating patients with a platinum-based regimen and bevacizumab as first-line treatment can register the outcomes of their patients in a large registry study, the ARES study, and there's also the SAIL registry study. Now, these are studies now that are accumulating up to 3,000 patients. What's very interesting is that the fatal pulmonary hemorrhage rate has dropped to 0.5% or lower. So clearly in the community hands, the risks of a fatal pulmonary hemorrhagic event occurring with the use of bevacizumab is far lower than it was either in ECOG 4599 or the AVAIL study for reasons that are not clear.
Well, I guess wouldn't the reason be selection of patients and maybe stopping therapy early or something like that?
You know, it's interesting. As we've gone through the data, we really don't understand.
That's true.
What? You know, there are more performance status 2 patients. Those were excluded from ECOG 4599 and AVAIL.
Right.
There are more elderly patients in this study, and the accrual of elderly patients over the age of 70 to ECOG 4599, although it was a new high for ECOG, it still was only a small fraction of the patient. And when we've looked at tumor location, central versus peripheral, cavitation, yes or no, none of those appear to be predictive.
So I'm going to make a wild guess and say, in general, the most common initial therapy you start these kinds of patients on is going to be carbo, pem, and bev.
That's the regimen that I choose for my patients who have non-squamous cell lung cancer off protocol when I have the opportunity and insurance doesn't give me a problem.
And how do you deal with it down the line in terms of maintenance therapy?
Well, I continue to use bevacizumab maintenance. And, you know, this is an important question that needs an answer. And I'm very grateful that ECOG is stepping to the fore. They have a new trial that's about to start in which patients will be treated with the ECOG standard, carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, and then there will be 3 maintenance arms. There'll be the standard arm of bevacizumab alone. There'll be a second arm in which patients will receive pemetrexed maintenance therapy alone, and a third arm in which they'll receive pemetrexed combined with bevacizumab as maintenance therapy.
And that's after what initial therapy?
Carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab. It's a very good and very important study. It'll answer some important questions for us.
And as always, if we can get some translational things along the way
exactly.
And figure it out, that might be pretty good.
Exactly.